I want to thank you both for taking the time. I know you're both, you got very busy schedules, and I do very much appreciate you taking the time to join us for this one-hour teleconference call. For those people who may not be aware of who you are, the work that you're doing, let me just give you a quick introduction. Dr. Kellerstein graduated from the University of Toronto in June of 1976 with a special interest in physiology and zoology. He received his chiropractic degree in 1980 and his naturopathic degree in 1984, and he graduated from the Canadian Academy of Homeopathy in 1991. That's the institution associated with André Sain. He's been practicing since 1983, providing chiropractic and homeopathic care, and his principal homeopathic instructors have been André Sain and also Robin Murphy. Dr. Kellerstein was the first chairman of the Department of Homeopathy with the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine, and he currently lectures in homeopathy at the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine and also the Toronto School of Homeopathic Medicine. Dr. Kellerstein also operates his own postgraduate course in homeopathy called Homeopathy by the Book, which includes clinical preceptorship training with his students. Dr. Sain is a graduate of the National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon, which he graduated from in 1982. He's a board-certified homeopath, which he was certified in 1988 by the Homeopathic Academy of Naturopathic Physicians, and he's been teaching and lecturing on homeopathy since 1985. Dr. Sain primarily focuses on very serious chronic disease cases. He's been the dean and main instructor for the postgraduate program at the Canadian Academy of Homeopathy since 1986. Dr. Sain is one of the most sought-after teachers, holding seminars in Canada, the United States, and all over Europe. He is one of our foremost homeopathic scholars and has a tremendous background in pure Hahnemannian homeopathy. Now, that's the facts as I read them to you from a piece of paper. But let me just say personally that the two people we have on the call today are really among the foremost homeopathic practitioners and educators that we have in our entire community. Dr. Sain is an incredible scholar of homeopathy. I remember visiting him in Montreal a number of years ago and mentioning some obscure article in some journal. He knew exactly what article it was. He actually knew who the author was, and I think he even knew the volume of which journal and probably which page number it was on. So that's the level of knowledge he has in homeopathy. And he's also an incredible practitioner. He only treats very serious cases because he's so much in demand, and he wants to focus his proficiency in the art and science of homeopathy on really being able to help people who are in a very serious health situation. Dr. Kellerstein is amongst one of the better practitioners in the community and an incredibly gifted educator. And I just wanted to share a quick story about Dr. Kellerstein. I had the opportunity to participate in a seminar, actually it was a series of follow-up cases over a period of a day, and I think there were 8 or 9 follow-ups during that day, and during that period of that entire day, every single patient was doing significantly better. And not only were all the patients doing better, but his students were able to understand exactly why they were doing better, they were doing better, and knew the remedies that had been given. So not only was he a very accomplished practitioner himself, but he actually has the ability to communicate that proficiency so that others can duplicate what he does. So as I said, we've got him on the phone here amongst the two of the most talented and gifted practitioners and educators in the entire homeopathic community. So again, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us on the call today.
Thank you, Ken.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So I know you're doing this new program, and I'll ask you about some of the details about that program in just a little bit. But first of all, I wanted to ask perhaps André first. What do you see is the state of homeopathy practice in the world today?
The state.
How do you see what's going on in the
hospital? I'm not to judge that because I don't go in people's practice because that's where really you would see it. However, I can report that last September, a year ago, I was at the international conference in Germany, and there were practitioners there from every continent. And it was the consensus that less than 10% of people that study homeopathy for about 3 years, let's say postgraduate to medicine or postgraduate or perhaps a professional course or some extended training of 3 years plus, 10% of these people, after they graduate, they do not practice homeopathy within a few years. And remarkably, one of the when this was discussed, it was a homeopath, a very scholar and a very from Argentina, said, actually, in Argentina, there's three postgraduate schools for homeopathy, and I can testify that less than 5% of people practice after 3 years after graduating from their program. Less than 5%. So that's the state. The state is poor education, poor practice, and poor image for the profession.
Mm. Joe, do you have anything you'd like to add to that, any comments?
Well, I can certainly concur with what Andre said. Teaching here in Ontario and having the opportunity to travel a little bit, I notice here in Ontario, there are several schools of homeopathy of the kind Andre mentioned, the three-year plus, and certainly it is the 90-plus percentile that after a few years are not in practice. And what I hear over and over again from students, and what is so heartrending for me is they have this enormous love of the subject and want so much to learn and continue, and at the same time, feel so little confidence in what they're doing and able to build a practice. Often the mechanics of practice itself, taking a case, doing a follow-up. To me, this is a tragedy, you know. Never has homeopathy really been so loved, misstudied, and ultimately not practiced. We have an enormous opportunity here for homeopathy, and it's heartrending that we can't take greater advantage of it.
So, gentlemen, I'm curious, and either one of you can answer this. Why do you think that the education is so poor? I mean, we have the Organon, we have chronic diseases, we have all of these old journals that are a documented record of the efficacy of pure Hana, meaning homeopathy. Why are people not focusing on that? Why are they focusing on so many of these newer approaches?
Andre, you go first.
Well, I guess it's more like the blind is leading the blind. So it's an old story. So if somebody improvises themselves as teacher and they have new methods and so on, they will attract a lot of people. But at the end, it will be disappointment. What can I tell you? That's the state of the state of homeopathy today. Is mostly the blind is leading the blind. So the student doesn't know better what is real homeopathy, and the one that has the best voice, they go for it. The one that looks the most attractive, they go for it. So they get misled, and they it's downhill from there.
You know, Kim, can I comment on that?
Yeah, please, Joe.
Just to speak a little bit about some of my own travels in trying to self-educate. You know, when I first graduated as a naturopath, the only thing I did know, I mean, we had a certain level, except it wasn't all that good, but I had a certain level of understanding of homeopathy, and I knew I was madly in love. I knew there was no going back, and I had to get myself educated in some way, but there was no real formal education. I don't think I really understood at all what was going on. So I was very much attracted to certain seminar leaders, very popular at the time, who were very charismatic, very intelligent people. And when they started to teach things that were in direct contrast to what I had read in some of the classics or was trying to understand in the classics like the Organon, I guess I suspended disbelief in favor of the current lectures, the ones that I had, the ones that were going to show me some sort of path in practice. And quite honestly, it wasn't until 1986 when I joined the Canadian Academy and I started listening to Andre. And it took a while. It took a while to almost detox my brain that I started to get some minimal degree of clarity as to what was actually going on in homeopathy. And even then, I lost focus for a while and headed off to a different kind of charismatic seminar leader. And again, total confusion. I entered a world, you know, I recall sitting down at lunch with a bunch of extraordinarily intelligent people. And I was a little suspicious of the place I was at and the kind of homeopathy or supposed so-called homeopathy that was being taught. And there was a gentleman there, a Harvard-trained physician, brilliant man. I was saying, you know, if this is true, what is homeopathy? And the answer I got is, well, we don't know what homeopathy is anymore. It can be many, many different things. And that really echoed in my ears for some time until I stopped going there and came back and started rereading The Organon and some of the classics. And I understood, no, these are completely different subjects, but it's so easy to mess up your own mind. And it's not to say that I don't know what these other people are teaching or what their results are. I can't comment on that. But it's so important to know that if you're studying geography, you're studying geography. Homeopathy is a subject with a particular philosophy and practice laid out in the Organon. And I think that's perhaps the least studied of all books in so-called homeopathic schools today.
I know, gentlemen, one of the experiences that I've had is because I travel around a lot and, you know, I meet a lot of different teachers and practitioners from all over the world. And, you know, a lot of times I'll hear a comment from them to the effect that they studied classical homeopathy, you know, quote unquote classical homeopathy, and it didn't work. And that's why they've gone on to these new approaches. And then, you know, we'll have a discussion about that. And in the course of the discussion, what I'll discover oftentimes is that they actually don't really know what real Hahnemannian homeopathy is. You know, they won't be familiar with, like, really important fundamental aphorisms of the Organon, which are essential to knowing how to actually practice correctly. And so I get the realization, and I think one of you said, I think Andre said this earlier, that they themselves have not been educated properly. So they don't really have that foundation, and consequently, they because they didn't get trained properly in the first place, they didn't get good results, and so now they're off doing these other newer approaches. Have either of you had that type of experience as well?
Well, certainly, you know, there are a number of schools here in Ontario, and very often I'll have the privilege of having a preceptor for the day, and I enjoy that, you know, and it's nice to speak with these students, but I agree with you, Kim. Generally, there is not so much knowledge of Organon, very little knowledge of the polycrests these days, and very little knowledge specifically of the repertory. People seem to also have a lot of mythologies around what should be. Let me just give you a little anecdote. You know that in my course, Homeopathy by the Book, we get an assortment of people, both from naturopathic colleges, homeopathic colleges. One day there was this very brilliant gentleman who was also a PhD in his own field in physiology. And I handed out, just to get a feel for where students were as they first entered the course, I handed out a very clear case. You know, it was a sulfur case. And I wanted the keynotes to be obvious, but I just wanted to see people as they worked through the repertory and put the symptoms together to create a kind of genius to the case. And I saw this man rubbing his head and having a great deal of difficulty. And here's somebody who I respected greatly for his mind. And I said, "What's the problem?" You know? And he came back to me and he said, "Well, you know, I kind of think this is a sulfur case, but I know it can't be, because I know that we first need to take the mental symptoms of the dominant miasm into account. I can't figure out what that is." So here's somebody who was taught a kind of methodology, and it was far more hampering than helpful, and he couldn't see the clarity that really is homeopathy. Very upsetting.
Maybe a little later on, if we have some time, we can discuss a little bit about miasms. That might be interesting. But before we do that, I know you guys are starting this program in Toronto. And what month are you starting that? Is it in October?
Yes, it's October. It's, I believe, October 4 and 5. Is that it, Andre?
Likely. Let me look at the calendar. Yeah, 4 or 5.
Okay, October 4th. And I know the title of the course is called Hanumin Prescribing. I'm curious, Andre, could you explain to us what that means, Hanumin Prescribing, and what is that? How would you define Hanumanian homeopathy versus?
It's prescribing. So we're prescribing medicine according to the method of Hanuman, or you can say the method of Hanumanians that have followed Hanuman and have increased beyond that. So we're prescribing the medicine according to the method of Hanuman and his follower called Hanumanians, simply.
Mm-hmm. And is there a specific, is there a specific definition for Hanumani prescribing other than, you know, what Hanuman came up with? I mean, could somebody evolve that system and it still be Hanumani prescribing?
Totality of the case.
Yeah.
What is most peculiar in this case? Which is the remedy that is most similar to the genius of this case, to the totality of the characteristic symptom? Prescribing the remedy in the right pathology? Do accurate follow-up, and always based on sound reasoning and accurate observation.
Hmm. Andre, could you define, some people may not be familiar with the term genius. Could you give us a sense of what that means?
Well, the genius is basically the totality of the characteristic symptom. It's like the fingerprint of somebody's disease. So if you say, what is the genius of this disease? You say, well, this patient is a patient with multiple sclerosis, but that doesn't give you a genius. That is a chilly person that is actually worse with hot, wet weather. So it's a chilly person, not wet weather. It's a peculiar thing, but it's special to this patient. That I'm trying to think of my patient of yesterday. I can remember something beside that one. But we say what is most striking about the person's symptom. Yeah, here's a chilly person that cannot tolerate the hot, wet weather at all, or hot room, or the sun. So that's peculiar. And then you say that is very sensitive to A, B, C, and D. So the sensitivity defines a lot of the susceptibility of the person. So all of these characteristic, very strong characteristic, are the totality. When you organize it with the most important, what is the most striking aspect in a case, and then you go down from there, it's called the genius of the case.
Mm. Joe, did you want to add anything to that?
No, not at all. It's
okay.
I think the most, you know what, we spend so much time studying homeopathy, but getting a direct and clear understanding of what Andre just said, that no matter what the disease is, what your context is, what your general context is in terms of a medical label, it always boils down to the genius of the case and what is most characteristic in this case of disease. Yeah, and getting there and just saying it's always the genius. It's very, very difficult for us to come to that in practice sometimes.
But this is what you're going to be focusing on in this course that you guys are going to be running.
Yes, that will be the focus, to both demonstrate it clinically with live cases, and to go through it and hone that kind of skill in the students with practice cases from the literature, from current practice. That will be the focus. It'll be a practical focus.
This is perhaps easy to.
I'm sorry, Andre. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's easy to learn to take a case. If you're properly trained, I have no problem with my student taking their case. They show it to me. I see that it's a nice, complete case because there's a way of doing it. It's just the art of it and to learn the subtlety that comes with time. But to learn to do a basic case, it's easy to learn. Any student can learn to do that if you're properly trained. But to be able to analyze the meaning of what of the answers and of all the symptoms, that needs experience or knowledge, a lot of knowledge, knowledge of medicine, knowledge like of pathology in general, knowledge of human nature, knowledge of ethology, you know, the science of behavior, to know if something is particular or common. So you need a lot of knowledge, and also a great knowledge of the homeopathic materia medica to be able to evaluate the characteristic value of a symptom. And that comes with a lot of experience. So when you demonstrate this art in class by taking a case, everybody sees a case, they see how it's taken, so they learn how to take a case, and then you have to analyze the case, then they have to develop judgment. You know, like Hippocrates says, life is short, the art of learning medicine is long, nowadays it takes a long time, but the judgment is difficult. So judgment will always remain difficult because it's something that it needs to be always honed and refined, and there's always place for improvement to develop a good judgment. So the case-taking in class and case analysis and doing the follow-up to, in other ways, analyzing the patient's response to the remedy is always very helpful to develop, to hone this judgment that is so essential for good practice.
Sure. And I would imagine it's just, you know, really working with somebody who's competent in those skills and practicing over and over again to see exactly how it's done so that it becomes almost second nature to that student or practitioner.
Exactly. And, you know, like I do with the students, I, you know, if they don't know what to look in a case, what is characteristic, let's do 10 cases. And then after 10 cases, you will start to have a hint of what to look for, what is characteristic. And after 100 cases, you'll have a clearer idea of what to look for in a case. But if you do 1,000 cases, whether it's paper or live case, you do 1,000 cases, and you have somebody to help you to analyze and so on, then you don't need any more teacher to tell you what to look for, what is peculiar in a case.
Mm. Yeah. Now, I don't know, one of you mentioned earlier about the fact that you were going to, the emphasis of the program was going to be on the success of the students, so students could go out there and feel confident and successful in their ability to practice. And I, you know, from my travels, this is one of the things that I perceive to be a real problem in our community, is that a lot of people graduate from schools and they really don't feel confident about going out there and practicing. And as you said, only 5 to 10% actually continue in their homeopathic practices. So I'm curious, maybe, Andre, you could start by sharing with us what steps you think need to be taken to make a homeopathic student really confident and successful in their practice.
I think it's very simple. You teach them the ABC of homeopathy step by step. You start with A and you finish with Z. And you associate that with a clinical program. And in our case, it's case in class because we don't have a clinic, a mutual clinic where we can have a student, a supervised student. So it's done in class. So they do it. The part they do is observation. So if you teach them the ABC and observation, at least they start to have a good foundation to base their future study on. So they will have a very, very clear foundation, both in theory and practice, of the principles and how it's done. So it's very simple. Clear principles, A to Z, and with a demonstration, with detailed explanation of the analysis of a case. We will take perhaps 2 hours to analyze a case. Maybe we'll take 3 hours to take a case and 2 hours to analyze it. And then we will take maybe 2 hours to do follow-up, maybe because the patient will have two follow-ups, so half hour to ask questions to the patient and maybe half hour to discuss the case with the student. So we take a lot of time for each case to be for detailed explanation of the symptomatology, of the pathology, of the course of disease, of the course of recovery, of the response to the remedy.
So Andre, I just want to get this clear. You're not going to simply do a case and then work through the case and say, okay, here's the first prescription. You're actually going to look at subsequent prescriptions as well.
I didn't understand what you said. The sound was not good.
You're going to look at the case management of a case over a period of time, not just that first finding that first remedy, but actually prescribing over an extended period of time, over many years, actually.
No. But when we do new case in class, those cases will come back in class 2 times probably for follow-ups.
Okay.
So we will do 2 live follow-ups on some case. Some case will have only 1 follow-up, but some may have 2, and some maybe, I'm not sure, I will have to look at the schedule, some may have even three follow-ups. So, because it's done over a course of 10 months. So people will be able to see the evolution. They will be able to see the reaction of the patient. They will be able to develop judgment about how to evaluate this. They will be able to ask questions. So it's a good, very good way to for training when you don't have a supervised clinical program.
Interesting. Joe, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I wanted to add, you know, from, again, just going at it from the perspective of the student. I recall back in 1986 when I first started my studies with Andre, this was pivotal. You know, it's one thing to study Materia Medica. It's another thing to study rubrics in a repertory. But it was so important for me as a student to notice, A, sort of the pace and the rhythm at which questions were asked and answered, the ability to observe close up the interaction of a teacher and a patient. And then later on, for a teacher to say to me, this is that rubric, and this is of that intensity. So suddenly I'm learning, you know, like a mechanic learns how to use a wrench. I'm learning how to use language and interpret it into the repertory, where to put my reliance. Because the teacher, specifically here, Andre, would say, did you see this? Did you see the intensity with which he did it? Did you notice the context and the emphasis and how important this particular symptom was? So you get to reflect immediately upon the experience. In that way, it actually becomes more a part of your toolkit. That was so important to me. It was so elemental that when I teach now, for example, you know, when I teach a clinic, for example, like the one you observed me in that day, I try to come out between cases and say, well, what did you see? So we can explore possibly what we saw, how to interpret it into the language of the repertory, how to assess its intensity, later on how to perhaps question ourselves as to its significance in the case. You know, this is where you take it apart, put it back together again, see if it runs. These are the important parts in the construction of your paradigm and practice.
So this is basically a one-year program, and it's essentially designed for people who have some foundational studies in homeopathy. Is that correct?
Andre, go ahead.
Listen, homeopathy is so basic. The training of the principle of homeopathy is so clear. It doesn't matter if somebody is a beginner or advanced. It's the same principle. The method of taking a case, whether somebody is a beginner or it's an advanced, is the same principle. The judgment is the same. So the course is not for advanced or beginners, for homeopaths or people that want to practice homeopathy. And if somebody is not sure about their principle or they're not satisfied with their result in practice, then the course is indicated. If somebody is very satisfied with their result in practice, they have they don't have any point of confusion. The principle are clear. The results are predictable. They don't need to take this course. Mm. Course is for people that want to have success. Perhaps they don't have success yet, or they are just student right now, and they're expecting to be successful in the practice of homeopathy. Right now, we know that most people that follow training will not be successful. That's predictable in general. And like Joe said, very predictable for people graduating from school in Ontario, particularly, but also elsewhere. It's the same state around the world. So the class is for those people. The class is for people that are not satisfied with their result in practice.
Okay. But Andre, the person would have to have some basic knowledge, right? They would have to know what a repertory is, or do they not even have to have that basic type of knowledge?
Oh, if somebody comes to class that has no knowledge of what is a repertory, then we would refer them to some basic information. But they will still benefit from the class.
Okay. Okay, good.
They would have to do more homework.
Yeah. But they could still do it, basically.
Sure, sure, because we're teaching principle and we're doing demonstration. So from the principle, and they will learn the principle and they will see the demonstration. They will just have to do more homework between during the month, between the 4 weeks of between two lectures, they will have to do more homework.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Joe, I'm curious, after the initial year of study, are there other options for more detailed study? Because, you know, 1 year is not enough for everybody to be able to become proficient, especially if they're fairly new. So is there possibilities for further study in the program?
Well, you know, if a person wishes, if they want to study more in depth, there are two possibilities. The first is Andre has a video course available for purchase on his website, the Canadian Academy Program. As well, I have the course Homeopathy by the Book, where we'll have a second and a third year, where we can get more in-depth in a more aphorism-by-aphorism study of the Organon. We can continue with the study of live and paper cases, and more in-depth study of various of the subjects that we covered in first year. Also, students of the course, I can't speak for Andre, but I know Andre takes preceptors. I take preceptors as well. Students can come and sit with me and see that, you know, what we teach is what we do, and can judge for themselves. Are there results? They can sit and we can discuss and ask questions. Also, for those people who want to really go into depth, there's a clinical internship program that I offer that we can tailor to the needs of the individual, but that would be reserved for people who were more serious and wanted to go more one-on-one with some in-depth study.
Okay, good. Andre, did you want to add anything to that?
No, that was clear. That's fine.
Okay. Okay, good. And so I'm just curious for each one. I'd like for each one of you to answer this. What is your vision for the future of the homeopathic profession? So maybe, Joe, you could start first, and then Andre could share a little bit.
Well, my vision, my hopeful vision of the future is the establishment of a community, a group of colleagues, like-minded colleagues, who wish to study and advance pure homeopathy. You know, the history of this profession, I think, has been so discontinuous. You know, it advances to a point and history to some extent submerges it. We have so much to offer the world, so much in the way of the relief of suffering, and at such a reasonable, almost, you know, comparatively infinitesimal cost for pure homeopathy to submerge again would be just unbelievably awful. I would love to see the establishment of a small group, you know, hopefully a large group of dedicated individuals dedicated to pure homeopathy and its advancements. I'd love to see the establishment of larger, perhaps even four-year full-time schools for the study of homeopathic medicine as it should be studied. I'd love to see what Andre spoke of many times as a wonderful vision is, you know, the reestablishment of the IHA, a group of people dedicated to pure homeopathy. It needs to be preserved. It needs to be advanced.
For those people on the call who are not aware, IHA is the International Hanumanian Association, which was formed in 1881. Is that correct, gentlemen?
Say again, Kim?
Yeah, it started in 1881, the IHA, International Hanumanian Association.
I believe that was the first journal. Is that correct, Andre?
1880.
Okay. Okay, good. So, and Andre, would you like to share a little bit about your vision for the future of homeopathy?
Well, homeopathy will go up and down depending on the times. Right now it's a downtime. Very popular. Homeopathy is very popular because a lot of people are there's more people educated, and there's more people that are aware of the danger of of allopathic medicine, and it's a bit the same as perhaps the 1830 when homeopathy really became very popular, because the population in general, especially the educated people, were distrusted the conventional medicine at the time. For instance, in New York, from 1830 to 1850, it is said that, if I recall, that half of the tax, half of the money from taxpayer came from homeopathic patrons. But they were treating only perhaps 1/8 of the population at that time, but more than half of the taxpayers. So that means there were the educated people that were following homeopathy. And there's two reasons for that. First, because people were distrusting conventional medicine, and the second thing is the outstanding result that homeopathy got during time of epidemics, which really illustrate their superb results, illustrate the value of homeopathy, and after epidemics, people follow homeopaths as the family physician rather than regular physician. So right now we're not in times of epidemics, but if epidemics come back, I think it would be very, very favorable for homeopathy. But despite having no major epidemic right now or pandemics, homeopathy right now it's going down, and I predicted that 15 years ago. However, it will come back. There will always be epidemics. There will always be educated people. They always want people will have homeopathy. Want to have homeopathy. There will always be practitioners that practice well homeopathy, and there will be always people that don't practice well. The story will never finish. It's always the same story. However, we can do our effort to help the situation. And like Joe said, I think the IHA, the reactivation of the IHA, which was a major major force to educate the profession in the 1880s, I think it's needed the same as at that time, perhaps more needed today. And I think if it's if the IHA is well developed and founded correctly, it will last for a long time, hopefully longer than let's say the last meeting was in 1959. So 59 plus 21 years, so that's 80 years. So it lasted 80 years. So perhaps, hopefully, it will last more than 80 years this time if it's funded correctly. But I think that's the best we can do is if we can associate, because association means strength, and internationally, so the people from all countries. So if we bring our resources together, we share our knowledge, and we raise money to develop institution, research project, or Mater Medica project. Like right now we're working on a project of Mater Medica with a group of about maybe 100 practitioners. But, you realize that this work should have been done 100 years ago. So we're 100 years late on this work. But by getting together, uniting, we can do the work that we have been delinquent to achieve in the last 100 years, and I think the IHA will have the potentiality to have that force within the profession, like leadership force.
Andre, I had the opportunity to see that wonderful debate at the University of Connecticut. By the way, you did a fantastic job on that, and I think anybody who was truly unprejudiced would have clearly felt that homeopathy was a legitimate science. And I wanted to address specifically how you documented the efficacy of homeopathy in the treatment of these epidemic diseases. And I think also I remember you once were quoted as saying that Lippe, if you can quote me, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I remember you saying that Lippe, in his basically 50 years of practice, and he had a very busy practice in the Philadelphia area, that in that 50-year period he basically never lost one typhoid, cholera, or malaria case. And that's an amazing level of success where you have 100% success with these very deadly types of diseases. And I oftentimes, when I travel around, Andre, I'll mention this, that when these people practice pure Hahnemannian homeopathy like Lippe did, you know, where he was an advocate and would never capitulate on those principles, that when they did that they achieved these incredible levels of success. And then sometimes people will respond and say, well, that was back then. Back then, classical Hahnemannian homeopathy worked, but, you know, things have changed, and now we need newer approaches. And I'm curious if both Andre and Joe, if you could comment on that rebuttal.
This is Andre's work, so Andre, go ahead.
Listen, if people only knew they won't do what they're doing. If they only knew, but they don't know, so their sin is ignorance, which is, I guess, all our sin. But it's true. If you read the literature and you look at what these pioneers and old timers did, is totally phenomenal. For instance, you say Lippe, but Lippe had fantastic success, but he was not the only one. People will, when you read the literature, it's constantly like this. Guernsey would often comment, you know, like he's never lost a case of a patient with typhoid fever. One time during an epidemic in Philadelphia, I think it was in 1864, major epidemic of diphtheria, which the death rate was over 50%. So that means out of 100 children that have diphtheria, more than 50 would be dead by the end of the week. Lippe, Herring, and another homeopath by the name of Heiklem treated over 300 patients without a death. So it's not just Lippe. Here was Herring at 120 patients about, and Lippe at about 180 patients, and Reclam had about 60 patients or so. So, but they had a 0% death. So that's not just Lippe, because they were following the same method. Guernsey well said, I've practiced homeopathy for almost 44 years at one point, he said that in his life, and I've never lost a case of pneumonia. Now listen, pneumonia's death rate at that time was 30%. Today it's 18%. So now when somebody says, yes, but it wasn't those times, but today people with pneumonia, it will be more difficult. I would say this is completely wrong, because my experience, perhaps over 200 cases of patients with pneumonia over 25 years or 30 years now, I've lost one case, and it was just recently, about a year ago, but it's the case, I'm not even sure the case died of pneumonia. It was a case of a child with brain tumor, couldn't swallow anymore, aspirated, is vomiting, because of problem with swallowing, because of the brain tumor, and he never was able to cough out what he had aspirated, and the more he aspirated, the more he got in. So it was a very complicated case, but that's a case that I would say that perhaps died of pneumonia, but it was major complication from a brain tumor and the problem with swallowing, and he couldn't cough and so on. So this case I did lose. However, I saw some very, very, very tough case with patient with pneumonia, patient with cancer of the lungs with pneumonia, several of them actually, people with AIDS with pneumonia, people with children with on the deathbed with pneumonia, with viral pneumonia, they came out like nothing, very easy. So when they say, yeah, it's no more the same, it's just they don't know what they're talking about. It's just pure ignorance.
Okay.
You know, when you face these people that says these things, says, where are the facts? I want to know the facts. Now, where is the evidence? Is it just opinion or evidence? So when you go through the literature, you cannot escape from saying, wow, how did these people practice? And once you see this, you say, yeah, what can you make better? Now, what can you make better? When you don't lose a case of diphtheria out of 300 cases, when the mortality is 55%, when you don't lose a case of pneumonia in 45 years of practice, assuming that we all saw one case a month at the minimum in those days, because, you know, you had measles would go to pneumonia, diphtheria would go to pneumonia, typhoid would go to pneumonia, flu, colds go to pneumonia. So many infectious disease at that time people would have pneumonia with. Minimum, a busy practitioner, which Well was known to have a very busy practice, he would have at minimum one case of pneumonia a month. Some months he would have several, maybe in a week when there's measles, let's say, or scarlet fever. but maybe other months he would have not none. But overall, you say if he had 12 cases a year, that's probably very fair for those years. And if you multiply that by 45, that's 500 cases plus. So if he has not lost a case of pneumonia out of 500, what else can you? What else do you want more?
Joe, do you want to add to that?
I think, you know, of course I was listening, and what really rang through for me was that Andre said they were all following the same method. Here we have a system of medicine based on clarity, on pure observation, without deduction, and something, just as it says in the Organon, it has to be according to clear and comprehensible principles. It has to be reproducible. You and I have to be able to sit down to be able to discuss the same phenomenon. And here we have a group of pioneers that got results clinically that are totally unsurpassable. You can't do better. You just can't do better than that. And how on earth can you make a case for saying that today things are different? I think what's different is that so many well-intentioned people today don't have the opportunity to actually study in a proper academic environment and approach the study as if it were a pure academic pursuit, a real pursuit of medicine. Instead, it's become a charismatic pursuit where, you know, I'm going to take an end run. I'm going to simplify homeopathy. George von Keller wrote a wonderful, wonderful article in the Classical Homeopathic Quarterly in 81 that I constantly make my students read, only because I found it so instructive. In history, we have the constant desire to make an end run around the difficulty of slowly and gradually learning homeopathy, and it doesn't work. But this pure method with these wonderful old practitioners where they could sit down in the discussion room, you know, the IHA, and we can follow what they say today. We can understand why they prescribed and what they did, and it's crystal clear. It's unsurpassed today. As Andre said, what more can you want?
So, gentlemen, if somebody wants to get more information about the program, where do they go? Who do they contact?
They'll go to Andre's website. What is it again, Andre?
No, it's not Andre, but it's the Canadian Academy website. But it's the website is
homeopathy.ca.
No, www. I guess I don't even know how. Oh, I'll tell you in a second. It's very easy. www.homeopathy.ca.
Okay, so www.homeopathy.ca. And homeopathy is spelled the American way, is that correct? Not the British way.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's an information page that was put up there.
Is there a phone number if somebody wanted to call somebody if they don't have internet access?
514-279-6629. They talked to Francine. She's the coordinator.
Can you repeat that one more time for me, Andre, please?
514-279-6629.
Great. Well, gentlemen, this was a wonderful call. We only have a few minutes left, but I'm going to open up the lines and let some other people ask questions. We've got about 5 minutes. So let me go ahead and unmute the lines. And thank you both again. Can everybody hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Does anybody have any questions for Drs. Kellerstein or Dr. Sain?
I do. This is Barbara.
Hi, Barbara.
I just wanted to say hello, Andre. It's been a long time.
Hi,
and
Barbara.
I wanted to just share that I have studied Dr. Sain's work for some years and wanted to recommend to the students that you will never go wrong. His work is second to none. And be prepared to work hard in homeopathy. I think the shortcuts are so misleading and there are no shortcuts. But I would recommend his work and his additions to the repertory to anybody. And thank
Great.
You. Thank you so
much. Did you
much.
Have a question, Barbara, you wanted to ask?
No, I really just wanted to share that because, you know, there are many struggles we have as practitioners, but his work has just been a solid foundation that I have really gotten so much out of, and it stood me well through many ups and downs. So that's all.
Thank you. And just for people who don't know, Barbara is the former editor of Similimum and a very accomplished practitioner in her own right. Does anybody else have a question they'd like to ask?
Yes, I do have a question. I'm speaking from Las Vegas.
What's your name, please?
Ahmed Masood.
Okay.
I'm a student at the Resonance School of Homeopathy in Reno, Nevada. And my question is regarding that I apologize for that, but in a previous conference call with Whole Health Now, Dr. Sain said that Kent's repertory personalized and stereotyped remedies fixed an image with them. And then he continued, then Dr. Sain said that Kent was not taught in Hahnemannian tradition. Could you please, Dr. Sain, kindly explain this? I really appreciate it.
First of all, it's not his repertory. His repertory has nothing to do with when he his lecture on Mathematica. Sometimes he will characterize a remedy with a very, very crystallized stereotype. For instance, he will say the ragged philosopher for sulfur. Well, you know, you're not going to see many ragged philosophers around when you. Out of 100 cases, it will be just very minimal. So I know one time, I'm not sure, not too long ago, I was doing a class, and we had a case, and it was a case of sulfur, and one of the students couldn't understand it was a case of sulfur because the patient was nicely dressed and was not a ragged philosopher. So that form of crystallized two stereotypes will prevent people to use the Mathematica in a pure way and be able to adapt it in a pure way. In other words, the pure way is to take the symptom of the patient, to do the symptom, take the symptom of the patient and say, which remedy in the Mathematica corresponds best to this genus of the disease of the patient. Now, there was a second part to your question, which I forgot now, besides the Mathematica.
Yeah, the second part was...
Remember, Kim, or perhaps the student can...
Go ahead.
Kent was taught not in an Hahnemannian tradition.
He was not taught in an Hahnemannian tradition. He was self-taught. He didn't receive formal training from any homeopath. He was... his wife was sick. He was an eclectic physician, and... she requested to see a homeopath, and he accepted her request, and she was treated, and she recovered. And after that, he took up homeopathy, but he self-studied, studied by himself. And eventually, he was going to move from St. Louis to Philadelphia to practice with Lippe, to associate with Lippe, and there he would have learned the right way to do it. But unfortunately, when he arrived in Philadelphia, Lippe was already dead, so he had planned to practice with Lippe, but it didn't occur as Lippe had died just a couple of months before. However, he was very charismatic. He was a very good clinician. He had very good results. However, his training was not on Hahnemannian. He was not, and he deviated quite a lot during his career, especially at the end. He introduced a lot of personal things and things, religious aspect or spiritual aspect of homeopathy that has nothing to do with medicine, has nothing to do with pure observation. It's only speculation, and that would be non-Hahnemannian and misleading.
Good. I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. Does anybody have something they'd like to ask?
I do. I would like to know, this is Margarita. I have a lot of trouble repertorizing, like getting from the people, the clients or the patient's words to put it in the repertory. So is there a way that I can practice or what would be the advice?
That's a good question. This is, I'm not sure if there's a book for this. I don't think so necessarily, but the way I did it on the course that was given in the late 90s is we took 10 days for case-taking. In other words, we go over how to take a case. That means 10 days is about 6 hours a day. So that means 60 hours. So we go over the questions and what are the possible answers. And when we go over the answers is where do you find this answer in the repertory, in the language of the repertory. So we always have to interpret the language of the patient, especially modern language, into the a bit older English language of the repertory or medical language. So if there's any other way, I'm not aware of.
Thank you.
And this would be something that you'd be doing in this this year-long course with Joe. Is that correct, Andre?
No, because as you notice, it says, I said 10 days, 10 days of 6 hours. That's a long way of doing it. The course that we're giving is 10 weekends of 2 days, so that's 20 days. So we cannot spend 30% of our lectures on just case-taking. So the aspect of case-taking that we will do, we will teach the basic principle, but we cannot go over all the little detail. We're gonna teach the big chunks, but the little minnows they have to be picked up in another program.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you have another question, Marguerite?
I was gonna ask about that other way of teaching that I have seen in other practitioners, like they just go by the energy of the remedy and they don't repertorize, they just go in 5 minutes they have a remedy. I mean, they don't go through the whole process. Is that something that really can be done, or is just a new way of certain practitioners?
Joe, you can go for that one.
Okay.
Joe, you want to answer that one?
Yeah, I think it might be misleading. Sometimes older and experienced practitioners do, in fact, do a good inductive case-taking and can be quite thorough and arrive at a remedy very quickly simply because they've gone through the process for so many years, so many times. They've seen the symptoms. They know the outcome. They know what to prescribe. If it's something objective, a pathology with a certain characteristic appearance, they may know it, and the case may quickly confirm it. And once you have a case, you have a case. But if indeed the practitioner is prescribing based on something esoteric or other than pure observation and an inductive kind of reasoning, then he's not, by definition, practicing homeopathy. It's a homeotherapy or some other kind of therapy. You know, some people use pendulums. They may use radionics devices or other tools. This is not homeopathy, though they use homeopathic remedies. You could call it homeotherapy. You could call it just using homeopathic remedies esoterically, but it's not homeopathy. So it's either one or the other.
Okay, thank you.
So I see that we're out of time. I want to thank both Dr. Singh and Dr. Kellerstein for joining us again. And if everyone on the call could give a big thank you to these two gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Merci.
Thank you.
Thank you.